rti.com.
Welcome to today's episode of the RT Interview. We dive into the world of sustainable finance and climate-conscious investing. I'm thrilled to introduce our guest today. It is Craig Cameron, who brings a wealth of expertise as a portfolio manager and research analyst at the Templeton Global Equity Group. Craig is primarily responsible for overseeing the group's climate change funds, demonstrating his dedication to addressing one of the most pressing issues of our time. Since 2013, he has been deeply involved in the renewable energy sector worldwide. Hello, Craig. Thank you for joining us in our podcast studio today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Craig, let's discuss the impact of declining interest rates on the fight against climate change. How do changes in interest rates affect companies engaged in this issue?
Yeah, so I think the general rule is that interest rates are rising interest rates are a headwind for this theme, and declining interest rates are a tailwind. And if I can just explain why, to tackle climate change, we need to invest. We need to raise capital to build solar or wind or shift our transportation to electric alternatives. And in most of those cases, we are spending money today to reap a benefit in the future. And as any capital spending, you need to raise capital and you need to borrow money quite often for a large portion of that. So I think what we've really sort of seen over the last couple of years is rising interest rates, and that has been a headwind to the theme of decarbonization. And I want to clarify there, it is specifically related to long-term interest rates. So we're not talking about, you know, one-year borrowing or two-year borrowing rates. It's really the 5, 10, or even even longer duration interest rates that can have a meaningful effect on the returns that are available to people investing in these sorts of projects.
The normalization of interest rates is considered as a major trend for 2024. How do you view this development, and what effects will it have on the fund?
Yeah, so I think the fall in interest rates that is expected, you know, should in theory not just impact the short end, but also the long end of the curve. And so in that environment, I do think this interest rate headwind that we've seen over the last sort of year or two should turn to be a tailwind for the first time since really 2020, where we've had sort of declining rates that are helping this theme. We have a number of companies that are, I would say, more leveraged interest rates than normal. In our fund, for example, you know, some of the companies are not just borrowing money to finance and build projects, but they're also able to sell on projects based on, you know, what the yield that they're getting on these projects are. And so as a result, there's a sort of multiple impacts that are coming through to those businesses' profitability and valuation as a result of interest rates. So certainly I don't want to predict what happens to the fund in the future. That rarely works out well, but I do think that something that has been a headwind to us over the last sort of year or two is starting to become more of a tailwind going forward.
Let's touch the political aspects. There is also some fear of potential legislation changes in the USA, especially regarding the Inflation Reduction Act. How might such legislative changes impact the strategy?
Yeah, so there's an interesting sort of comparison when we look before, let's say before the Inflation Reduction Act was announced and where we are today. In many cases, the companies actually traded a lower valuation than they did back in, say, 2021. So we're in this somewhat strange environment where we've had one of the most meaningfully positive legislative shifts globally ever towards clean energy, towards investment in these businesses. But today the market is more concerned about the risk of it going away than actually the impact that it's already having on the ground right now. Certainly there is political risk. I don't think we can get away from that. There are a few mitigating factors, and I think you know, we can sort of talk through them individually. The first is obviously there's limited risk to the IRA if the Democrats win the US election later this year. It is a sort of flagship policy of the existing administration. And if anything, you know, in that environment, we would potentially see upside and further legislation to promote clean energy. If the Republicans get in, then the question is, to what extent do they have full control over not just the presidency, but also Congress and the Senate? Depending on the level of majority, we think there's a variety of different outcomes that could occur. And a sizable majority is probably necessary to push through meaningful reform to the Inflation Reduction Act. What I think is actually more likely is legislation that may cap the overall subsidy bill for the Inflation Reduction Act, or sort of reduce the longevity that it would have going out to potentially 2032 and beyond. So it's much more difficult to unwind the existing legislation as it's starting to work its way through into the tax code than it is to sort of add extra caveats and so on that would sort of supersede it. So I think there is certainly risk there. The other aspect is just to remember two factors. I mean, the vast majority of the investment spend and also the jobs that have been created as a result of the IRA so far have been in what we would think of as traditionally Republican parts of the United States. That matters because there are significant subsidies and significant investment now going into areas that are generally earning, they have lower wage rates and lower employment rates than the rest of the United States. And so it's actually been a crucial benefit for those, particularly Republican parts of the country. And that's generally been what I would call the grand bargain that the two parties have had over the last 10, 15 years, is that the Democrats bring in the legislation that promotes renewable energy. It creates a lot of jobs in what we would think of as the central belt and the south of the United States. And ultimately, if the Republicans then get power, they don't roll back those subsidies because they've had quite a positive jobs impact. And this example, the Inflation Reduction Act, is just that, but on a much larger scale. And so I do think economic realism is likely to blunt any major attempts to shift the legislation under a Republican presidency.
Decarbonization and deglobalization are expected to remain influential in the coming years. What long-term effects do you expect here?
Yeah, so I think that the reason that we talk about deglobalization alongside decarbonization is that the two often go hand in hand. And actually, the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States is no better example of this. The program, if from many angles you would argue, is not simply a decarbonization act. It's actually a jobs program to kind of promote employment in the United States. It specifically requires manufacturing within the U.S. and in some cases you can manufacture in a company with a free trade deal. But there are significant tax credits associated with domestic manufacturing. And that transpires all the way along the value chain. And so you also get companies that are finding that they get incremental tax credits because of the area that they're employing in. So if you employ in an area where wage rates are lower. So there are significant incentives, and I would describe it more as a jobs program than a decarbonization act. But of course, what that also brings with it is protectionism. So we are implicitly, with a program such as this, blocking out alternative sources of supply that may come cheaper, but ultimately are not manufactured domestically. A similar example I would use is the potential or now existing carbon border adjustment mechanism that the EU is sort of building. And the idea there is to use the purchasing power of Europe to implement carbon taxes on products that are not manufactured in Europe, which I think is a fantastically positive thing for climate change. The downside of that, of course, is what we inadvertently do is then create these sort of protectionist structures around Europe where certain products may then not be able to get into the country because effectively we're taxing them quite heavily. And so you start to see these fragmentation of industries, not just in solar panels, not just for wind turbines, not just for electric vehicles, but in many, many different parts of the supply chains, whether it's steel or copper or aluminium, the pricing of these products starts to shift and we start to see a fragmentation of the products globally. That's coming at the same time as, you know, for example, the US and China have increasing trade tensions. And we're also seeing the same impacts from obviously the sort of decoupling of the European and Russian economies together post the invasion of Ukraine. So I think a number of factors are driving towards a more deglobalized world, but also hand in hand with a hopefully a more decarbonized world as well. And those two factors, I think, are really driving a lot of the market sentiment and driving a lot of the long-term investment decisions and policies. It's one of the few things that both sides of the aisle agree on in the United States is to be, you know, have this more protectionist structure and resort to less imports from places like China.
Please tell us about the selection and weighting of different sectors in your fund, particularly focusing on climate change solutions and renewable energy, of course.
Yeah, so our fund breaks down into two broad categories. We call them solutions and transitioning companies. And to qualify for either category, you need to meet a minimum threshold of what I would call purity or green revenues is generally the metric we use. Solutions companies have to be 50% green. So more than half of what those companies do needs to be contributing towards climate change mitigation and adaptation. And that is, specifically what the company is providing. If the company is involved in adjacent industries and, perhaps doesn't really contribute towards climate change, but has a great decarbonization target, that will not count. It really has to be about what the company is making and manufacturing or providing as a service. And then for a transitioning company, you need at least 20%. Within those two groups, we then break them down into sub-themes. And broadly, there is between, some of them are as small as 3 to 5%, and some of them can be up to 15 to 20% of the portfolio. But we're looking to invest in multiple different areas or themes within climate change. One of those is renewable energy, but we also have energy efficiency, sustainable transportation, and so on. Within these groups, you can find multiple different companies that are impacting that specific area. But the one sort of consistent thing that you see throughout the fund is that we focus on four key sectors of the market. We are significantly overweight the industrials, materials, and utilities sector, and slightly overweight the technology sector. Those four sectors combined are around 90% of the fund. And that there's a sort of, a fairly logical explanation for that. That is, these are the parts of the economy that are really driving technological change. They're making the products that help us to decarbonize, and they are providing the services that we need to shift our economy towards a low carbon economy. Within that, I think the two largest exposures that we have are industrials and materials. And I like to say that to tackle climate change, we need to change the things that we make and the way that we make them. And to me, the industrials and the materials sector are essentially when we are making things and the materials we make them with. So those two sectors in particular are crucial for tackling climate change and as a result are significant weights in our portfolio.
Among the current top positions of the fund, we find companies like Saint-Gobain and Prysmian. How do these companies contribute to achieving the fund goals in energy efficiency?
Yeah, so I think these are two great examples of companies that at first glance, they're not related to the solar or wind. They don't make products in EVs. But they are incredibly crucial to the energy transition. To start with, Saint-Gobain is a world leader in sustainable building materials, everything from insulation to low carbon glass. And the business really, I think, kind of highlights that there are multiple different ways that we can decarbonize. One of the things that we like to look at when we analyze our companies is, what is the scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions of this company? So what is their carbon footprint? And then we compare that to what are their products doing? How are they helping us to decarbonize? In the case of insulation, which is a significant portion of Saint-Gobain's business, Insulation is actually one of the most attractive products that you can provide on this basis. The carbon footprint of the insulation that Saint-Gobain manufactures is very low, but the avoided emissions that you create by installing high quality insulation and reducing heating needs or heat loss from buildings is fantastic, and the return is incredible. So it's products like that where companies can have quite a significant impact on decarbonization without necessarily falling into some of the most obvious headline categories. To take Prysmian as the other example, we are building out significant quantities of solar and wind, and our grid is becoming incredibly difficult to manage. We need to deal with two-way power. We need to have a more resilient grid. We need to shift around solar and wind from sources of supply to those areas of demand. If you think 20 years ago, we would build a large fossil fuel turbine right next to a business park, and the businesses in that area would then use the power directly on site. Today, you can't do that if that's not where the wind is strongest or the solar terrain is the best. And so you're finding that you're needing to bring that supply from much further away. Prysmian manufactures the cables that we need to connect up all of these sources of supply and demand. And actually, not only are Prysmian connecting renewable energy to the grid, but they're also upgrading the cables that they manufacture so that the energy losses are significantly lower than they were in the past. So it's not just a sort of beneficiary of the transition, but they're also contributing as well by making sure that we're losing less of the energy we produce before it reaches that source of demand.
Let me please ask the last question. Will the capital market be able to influence the global climate fast enough?
Good question. Certainly, I think the capital markets can have a positive impact on climate change. And I would love to see more companies and ultimately consumers making decisions that can help us to decarbonize. There is only so far that companies can go without consumer support. You can make as many electric vehicles as you like, but if consumers don't want to buy them, then we won't decarbonize. And the same is true in multiple different industries. I think ultimately we need a combination of consumer awareness and decisions at the end consumer level. We need capital markets helping to steer companies into the right decarbonization technologies, the positioning themselves for the future rather than for the past. And we also need some legislation that can help us to direct it in that way. I mean, one of the metrics that I like to compare is to look at the total tax take in a given country, and look at how much of that is taken by carbon. And we'll find that the number is incredibly low. Now, given that government in theory should help us deal with externalities, carbon emissions are in my view, certainly up there with things like income inequality or, bad habits like, smoking or that sort of thing that we tax very heavily. So it's interesting that we're still yet to kind of break that barrier down and really shift the tax structure over to really incentivizing decarbonization. And of course, it's not just about government legislation, and it's not just about the consumers and capital markets. We need global agreement on things like carbon taxes that can help us get there. And I think those are sadly not on the horizon anytime soon, which is ultimately making it more difficult. I do think one of the sort of realities of the problem is, of course, that the longer we wait, the more that we need to spend, the more investment we need. And we're seeing that today. I hear a lot about the rising price of many of the materials and things like offshore wind or onshore wind, and regularly point out that they were significantly more affordable maybe 5 years ago or 4 years ago, and we installed far less of them back then. So there have been opportunities to decarbonize more aggressively, and as we pass up those opportunities, then things get more expensive in the future. But ultimately, we have to deal with the challenges one way or another. So hopefully a combination of all of the above is will get us there.
Thank you. Many thanks to Greg Cameron and The Insight. He is the lead portfolio manager for the Templeton Global Equity Group's Climate Change Funds. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Christian. Thanks for having me on.
LTE.com, the online portal for institutional investors in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. LTE.com.